Blog Talk Radio.
Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by The Fitness Buff Show, the leanest, fastest hour on radio. Check it out online at fitnessbuffshow.com and start getting fitter and faster today. Peanuts Treasury was the first hardcover book I remember getting as a kid, somewhere around 1968-69. I spent hours reading and rereading it, losing myself in the comic misadventures of Charlie Brown and Snoopy, wishing I could be like Charles Schulz, the strip's writer and artist. My first dog, acquired around that same time, was, not coincidentally, a beagle like Snoopy, whom we named Peppy, and I loved that crazy dog. I was so fond of Peanuts Treasury that it's one of the few prized possessions from my misspent youth that followed me through college, half a dozen adult relocations, and is now on my daughter's bookshelf. It's hard to find anyone who has anything bad to say about Peanuts or Schulz. The strip's creator lived and thrived in the pre-internet age, where the world didn't demand every detail of a celebrity's life be preserved and shared. For the most part, we knew only his good works and the enduring cartoon series based on them. In his new book, Schulz and Peanuts, biographer David Michaelis introduces readers to the real cartoonist behind the Daily Strip. Michaelis' previous biographical work includes a history of painter N.C. Wyeth. David, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks so much, Bob. Great to be here.
Good to talk to another cartoon biographer.
We're a weird small group.
It's a special group to be in. I wanted to ask you first. You write in the book that different people call Charles Schulz by different names, depending, I guess, on their level of familiarity with him and his comfort level with them.
Mm-hmm.
What would you call him if you met him today?
In my dreams, and I do meet Sparky occasionally in my dreams, we're on a first name basis, meaning the time, as you know, you spend with a figure and you're thinking about him and about his work and his life every day, you do occasionally meet up in a dream at night. And I've had a few where Sparky has called me David, and I've called him Sparky, and sometimes, trying to judge his expressions, I've tried to make sense of what he thinks of all this. But in real life, I would call him Mr. Schulz.
Yeah.
If I were opening the door of the Warm Puppy and saw Warm Puppy Lounge at the coffee shop, at the Redwood Empire Ice Arena in Santa Rosa, I would walk in and walk up to his table and say, Mr. Schulz, how do you do?
I think
he had a certain level of formality and decency and a kind of calmness that was inspired respect.
Now, what was going on in your life professionally when this book came along, and how did it come along?
Well, I was 2 years away from a previous biography of an artist, N.C. Wyeth, and I felt very strongly when I saw that Charles Schulz had died, that a piece of my childhood had just vanished. I was not unlike you in a very specific regard. I actually had a beagle too. And I noticed, in fact, that dog came to us from the pound and was given to us as a dog named Phooey, P-H-O-O-E-Y. And we thought that was a terrible name for a beagle, and so we renamed him Pooey. But it was actually, and which is what stuck with us, with this beagle. I also had a Linus sweatshirt, and I was very much in that moment in 1967, 68 of great self-identification with Peanuts characters.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, it was looking at these in these years of studying Peanuts as a as a biographer that I often came across one of Snoopy's exclamations repeated frequently in the early years, which was "Phooey," P-H-O-O-E-Y. He would yell, and I figured that was probably why the previous owners had named our dog that. So anyhow, I had a great, strong childhood feeling about Peanuts, and to find him now gone in the year 2000, which was itself a kind of, one of those years that people my age had been waiting for all our lives. And the year 2000 was so far in the future and seemed so impossible, I wondered if I would even be alive. And to that now find Charles Schulz gone within a month and a half of the turning of the millennium, it was a shock. And I remember thinking that when I saw Peanuts in its in its fullest accounting, which at the time you could, of course, the books were on the shelves and I pulled them down in the New York Times. I remember there were small displays of the characters, small little introductions, sensing for the first time how these characters that I felt I knew so well might be connected to his work and to his life. And overall, my sense was, gee, there is a moment here that maybe will close soon, but in which Charles Schulz can be seen for the first time in the context of the times in which he grew up and the times in which Peanuts was written and the times in which he himself changed and influenced through his work. And I thought a big, full-length, proper biography was not only due this American genius. I was still kind of mad at the Pulitzer Prize Committee for not awarding Charles Schulz a Pulitzer Prize. He seemed not to ever have been undervalued as strongly as he felt he was, but I certainly felt he'd been somehow overlooked in certain ways, and I thought his life had been told perhaps in a more simplified way than it, in fact, might ultimately reveal, that it might ultimately reveal greater complexity.
Now, it's one thing to have a thought in a vacuum that someone would make an interesting biography, and it's a whole nother to devote, what, 6-7 years of your life? How did you get the clearance early on to get the access to the people and the documents and everything else that you really needed to do something like this?
Well, in thinking over Schulz, I put it aside thinking I had no business writing about Schulz, probably because I wasn't known as or had not had adult professional training as a comics guy. I was not a writer about comics. I was a reader of comics, but not a writer of them, and never had written about comics in my professional life. But after I thought things over and got a with so many of these things, I think the subject chooses you rather than you choosing the subject. Two people came along in the next month or two after his death and said to me, apropos almost of nothing, except it turned out my own inner doghouse thoughts, hey, did you know that Charles Schulz spent a good deal of his adult life wishing to meet Andrew Wyeth and hoping to know Andrew Wyeth or loved his work? And I had just finished a biography of N.C. Wyeth and thought to myself, well, if there's a connection to Andrew Wyeth, presumably there may be a connection to this whole world that I've just been living in of illustration, and which was an undervalued art form in somewhat the same way that comics were. And I wrote to Charles Schulz's widow, Jean Schulz, and 10 days later heard back, and Jean Schulz said that her husband, Sparky, she would put it in the president, she said, you'll be glad to hear that my husband has your book. And it's on the table beside the drawing table at home, and he was reading it in the last months of his life.
Oh, my God.
And so it felt like not just a vote of confidence, but it almost had a it-was-meant-to-be feeling about it. Because partly, I think Wyeth and Schulz are very different people, and there's a very different story there. But to see this undervalued art form and relate it in some ways to comics was a starting point in some ways of understanding the comics and Schulz. But more than that, I felt strongly after looking into the images of Treasure Island and Robinson Crusoe, familiar images if you read those books, those Scribner Illustrated classics, and finding Wyeth's life in them, that this might be an approach to Peanuts. Mm-hmm. And that I felt strongly that there had to be more to Peanuts if it was as complex and nuanced as it seemed to be, and it had to relate in some way to his life.
Did you heard back from Jean, and how much time went by before you actually got started?
Well, I wrote to Jean in May. She wrote back. Now the month turned, and we were into June. We met in June because I happened to be out in California at a wedding about 2 weeks later. She agreed to meet with me. We met. We spoke at length about the subject of a biography, and we both agreed that to get started interviewing sooner than later, especially with the men who Schulz had known in the war. I think I learned recently from the Ken Burns documentary about World War II that now it's up to 1,200 GI 1,200 veterans a day dying off in 2007. So it was probably a slightly slower rate in 2000. But still, it was clear that to get to some of these men who knew him in the war, his neighborhood friends growing up, the folks who knew him at Art Instruction Inc., would be a great thing for not only the book, but also the archives of the Charles M. Schulz Museum, which was then pretty much still on the drawing board. And I agreed that my notes and interview materials and research materials should all be placed into the research center at the museum, so that there would be a kind of nucleus in the archive there. And I felt very strongly that was a great great thing to do, and that it would be in some service to the whole idea of an archive. I think that there was no question that people were still in grief about Schulz at the time, and my interviews began almost immediately. And I still, to this day, wonder whether or not, had I started a few years later, there might have emerged a different portrait, or there might have emerged. But people were really ready to talk to me about Sparky, and I found in my earliest interviews that I almost couldn't get a word in edgewise. And it's true of interviewing, as you know, which is that you go and see someone, and they have had a lifetime of experience with the person you're writing about, or they've had a half a lifetime, or anyway, a long relationship usually, and there's a lot to say, and you really don't need to say a thing. You can just, they want to tell their story. And I think Schulz had such a profound impact, not only on all of us readers, but those in his life too. And that was the first awareness I had of some of Schulz's, the nuance and subtleties of Schulz's character. But also, as I began to read the comic strip now in earnest, there was to me a whole world of that was embedded, and now was beginning to correspond to the things I was hearing about him in his life. And then to go to his correspondence and his business papers with the syndicate, opening up those, there was a richness suddenly, a kind of three-dimensional, sort of like those, I don't know if you played it when I remember as a kid, there was suddenly chess was played on Lucite in three, or checkers, in three dimensions, three levels of at the same time. I always felt it was a little like that with the interviewing the papers and the strip itself.
I suspect that a lot of the people that you interviewed, particularly the older people, found it easier to talk about Schulz shortly after his death than when he was alive, because he was very private, right?
And absolutely.
Did not want people talking about him. He didn't. So they were probably had decades of things that they wanted to tell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And yes, exactly. I think one of the complications that came up, the words I would hear about Sparky were that he was a wonderful man, as you and I would imagine, and that he was shy, and that he was humble, and that he was unchanged from his earlier days, usually, that he was generous, and that he was fun and funny and had a sharp, edgy wit at times. And there was always a moment in which someone would say, but there was more to it. That's all true. And there would be anecdotes and material presented along those lines, and very warmly and very appreciatively.
And
sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, David, before we turned on the tape, we were talking, and I was telling you that I had done this biography of Will Eisner, another comic legend. And in doing that, I can still remember sitting at the at the dinner table with him one night when he started telling me about his children, something that he had never talked about before, and then finding out, and I don't want to make this about my book or Eisner, but finding out at that moment that a lot of what had happened to him in the last 30 years had to do with the loss of his daughter as a teenager. And I knew at that moment that that was going to be the electrifying moment of the book. And what I wondered about, was there a similar kind of an aha moment in researching Schulz and learning about Schulz, or was it a lot of things?
I think it was an accumulation, without question. But I had moment after moment where I was surprised to learn that Schulz was more complicated than I could have guessed, and that I really was, with everybody else, I had a very specific kind of person. And my sympathies or my feelings about him grew and became, I became far more engaged with him as a man, as a person, than I had been before, because I found him fascinating, and I found what I was hearing about him fascinating. I think he had a very, the whole theme of love, for instance, he had a very difficult time throughout his life to hear the story told by those nearest him, to hear himself tell the story. Another great source for me was the interviews he had given to American newspapers over the years. He considered the newspaper his employer. He considered the managing editor of any newspaper who sent him a reporter to do an interview, he considered that person to be part of his job to respond to. So over the years, he'd made account of his life, sometimes day by day, week by week, and you could chart some of the changes in his views and his thinking as those went on. And I saw him again and again talking about, let me back up. I remember my first interview with Kathy Geiswhite, the cartoonist, and I remember as I was leaving her office, she said, you know, this is going to be fascinating for you because you're going to find out something right away. You're going to find out that Sparky is incredibly big and incredibly small at the same time. And she had made the point, Kathy, who had given a eulogy for Sparky some months earlier at his memorial service in Santa Rosa, and clearly understood him and clearly was a trusted and beloved member of his, I'm not sure if inner circle is the right word, but she was a close friend and knew him. It wasn't somebody looking in from the outside. She had known him. And she, I remember her saying to me in that first interview, you know, he always wanted to know if he was loved. He would test you. He would test you to see whether you really loved him. And he wasn't quite sure even then, once you had made your declaration, even kiddingly or even lightly, lightheartedly, or even passionately, or even with great depth of feeling, I love you, Sparky. She wasn't sure even then whether he could hear it. And I remember just before that seeing that last interview with Al Roker, in which he quite, with having had a stroke, in the context of his illness, he was very vulnerable. The vulnerability of Charles Schulz was suddenly very much there for the whole world to see. And that sense of vulnerability in which he was able to say, I'm not, I can't believe that what I did, that they loved what I did. I can't believe that what I did was that they thought it was so good. That he was, even now, at the end, after all, wondering whether he had, whether his work had been loved truly, whether he had been seen and understood, whether it was understood. That whole process that he had gone through in his entire life of becoming an artist, triumphing over doubts of all kinds in his background, his parents not thinking that a cartoonist would ever amount to very much, supporting him, trying to be the loving parents of an aspiring artist, his cousins being a little more cruel to him, saying, you know, you're never going to make it, you're never going to amount to anything. But that he fulfilled expectations, I mean, that he exceeded all expectations and fulfilled himself, but still could doubt whether or not what he had done was good. You know, he would say to Gary Groth, the editor of Comics Journal, in a very comprehensive interview at the end of his life, you know, have I had success? Do you think so? And mean it. You know, he wasn't just jesting. He wasn't being ironic. He really meant it. And you hear it over and over again, Schulz doubting whether he's loved, whether he's seen clearly, whether he's understood. And it goes back into some deep childhood stuff where he even sent back at one point something the way Linus would be sent by Charlie Brown to talk to the little red-haired girl
right
on the playground. I discovered that he had asked this Pudge Gadeldig, fellow golfer on the St. Paul Central High golf team, you know, to go back and talk to a girl that Charles Schulz, little Sparky Schulz, had been, you know, in love with, had a crush on the Lake Street streetcar, and he just wanted Pudge to go back to St. Paul and ask her, did you notice him? You know, did you see him? Were you aware that there was this boy who had a crush on you? When, of course, this is by then the early 70s, Charles Schulz, world-famous Charles Schulz, could have picked up the phone and called
right
Lila Bischoff and said, hi, Lila, you know, this is Charles Schulz. You probably don't remember me, ha, 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 but gosh, you know, I write the comic strip Peanuts, and I just want to talk to you about the old days. he would never have done that. And the whole feeling of being unseen and overlooked remained in his life, and I felt very strongly as I kept finding this out, as I kept learning how he didn't really want to free himself from a lifetime of yearning, longing, unfulfillment, on the one hand, anxieties, fears, worries, in addition.
Well, and I want to ask you about that. I mean, one of the things that struck me is that he never really matured in some ways. You know, sometimes we have these feelings when we're a kid, we have them when we're a teenager, that we don't belong, that we don't fit in, that no one understands us. But most of us grow out of that. And you know, by, 47, my age, you kind of feel like you're starting to get the hang of things. But
yep.
You get the sense that he never did. It never, you know, he had children, and I'm sure he loved his children, and he certainly loved his second wife. But you know, as a member of greater society, that maybe he just never did quite get it. He never did feel a part of things.
I think he was continuously aware that he didn't quite fit in. And that I remember a quote that I use as an epigraph where he said, "Cartoonists don't live anywhere." I think he had a sense of disconnection from the world and from the world around him, and he was in such an odd place after a certain point in his life with the kind of success that Peanuts had, with the kind of really quite unique place that Peanuts was in the culture, and he as a cartoonist, I mean, he almost had to explain himself, to explain himself after a certain point, because he was so much more than a cartoonist, and he kept things real for himself by living what he felt was, well, he would live on his own terms and he would live in an ordinary way. And I remember Clark Gessner saying this to me very early on. Clark Gessner was the fellow who did You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, who wrote the lyrics and composed the music, and eventually was part of the team that put that musical onto into the theater 80 St. Mark's in the 60s, and he had visited with Schultz and knew him to some extent, and he said, you know, this is going to baffle you for the entire time you're working on it, because Sparky presented himself to the world as ordinary. He resisted being treated as extraordinary, even though he knew he was. Even though he knew he had this talent, and even though he knew it was now projecting him and his work, could project him and his world into extraordinary stratospheres, undreamt of by a boy from, you know, Snelling and Selby Avenues in St. Paul. Still, he kept resisting anything like fame or celebrity, and he lived a life where he had to insist on being ordinary. And it put pressure on him. You know, it put a lot of pressure on him because at the same time he yearned for recognition.
Well, I think once one of your characters is in a balloon in the Macy's Day Parade, I think you pretty well established some measure. Now, there's a lot of the early headlines related to your book have had to do with this, that there's this darker side of him, that he had perhaps some psychological issues. Are you uncomfortable with that that emerging so quickly, and that maybe that defining the book?
Well, I'm hoping, as all writers do, that the book itself is read, and is read as carefully as the, you know, the blogs and the stories about the book, because I think that in some ways this whole debate misses the point of why biography, which is to understand Charles Schultz as Schultz understood himself. Not as his children understood him or as the world understood him, but as he saw his life. I mean, that's certainly the point of view from which I was trying to approach his life, both finding it through Peanuts, which is a more abstracted way of understanding how Charles Schultz knew the world, but how he, in his own words, understood. If you take simply the issue of his melancholy, which is the word he used to describe the daily sense or weekly sense of angst and dread and strong feeling of doubt and in some cases even doom. This was the language he used to describe himself. There was never a diagnosis given by a doctor that was then embraced by Schultz and others about his condition, if you want to call it that, or his situation. But he himself understood himself to be doubtful, insecure, uncertain, fearful, worried. I could keep going, but it would all be too much all of a sudden to hear all this without, you know, saying as well, yes, did he enjoy life? Well, you know, you couldn't be literally a victim of clinical depression and be as productive as he was. There's not a chance. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have found Charles Schultz doing what Charles Schultz did, which was to live with and overcome these things. I mean, in a real sense, he was Charlie Brown because the central quality of his life was fortitude. It was getting up every day and trying again.
Well, I was going to ask you, were there periods in his life where he could not get up and produce?
No, that's just it. You see, this is why his children quite rightly object to a world that's saying Charles Schultz was an unhappy man universally. I mean, categorically across the board, which is not also what I think my book is a very sympathetic portrait of a guy overcoming and dealing with his worries. The central story of the book is the achievement of Peanuts, the achievement of creating this comic strip that became the world over beloved and embraced, and he became the most popular visual artist of the 20th century. You couldn't do that and, A, be a depressed person, but you also couldn't do that and be a normal person. We're talking about an artist. We're talking about a complicated artist, a guy whose complications were the stuff of his art, where he made conscious and deliberate choices not to get help for his struggles, but to continue to tap into them and use them as the sources of his art.
Well, one of the great devices in the book, and if I hope you don't mind the term device, but
no.
One of the great devices in the book is that as you're reading, there are Peanuts comic strips that are dropped in that, among other things, besides being entertaining, they start putting his life and the things that he felt and the way he did things in context. And I wanted to ask you, which came first?
Yeah.
The anecdotes or the strip? Did you tailor the strips to match up with the anecdotes or vice versa? How did that all come about? And that must have been very time consuming in and of itself.
Well, more I think the uncovering of the life, the revealing of the life in the slow, steady process, or actually sometimes very sudden leaps that one makes at the beginning, came first. In other words, as I spoke to people, as I gained some understanding from papers and documents and records of how Schultz had lived his life, how he saw the world, how he interacted with people, how he did and didn't change at first glance from boyhood to adulthood. It was suddenly the big themes of unrequited love, the big themes of Schroeder's devotion to art as something that will make him absolutely oblivious to this overpowering girl at the end of the piano asking for his attention. The longing for a little red-haired girl, you begin to see the big themes emerge in broad strokes. But then, you know, some little pieces of the puzzle float up, and suddenly there I am looking into a drawer, and, ooh, there's a picture of a girl, attractive girl in probably the 1940s, to judge from the dress and light and quality of the photograph. And then there, the next time I'm in Minnesota asking one of his art instruction colleagues, you know, there was this photograph. Did you know? Oh, that's Naomi Cohen. Oh, everyone was in love with her. Yeah, Sparky probably had a crush. Oh, yeah, Sparky did have a crush on her. I remember, you know, and then suddenly emerging a figure of Naomi Cohen, and then suddenly I'm finding Sparky talking about her in several interviews now that hadn't been out before, and suddenly a portrait is emerging. And because of the United Media database, the comic strip library, I could now go and type in Naomi.
Right.
And then suddenly up would come, whoa, suddenly here in 1992, here's Charles Schultz putting Naomi Cohn into a strip. And, oh, yes, in fact, this character, Naomi in Peanuts, is wearing a beret. And that turns out to have been the characteristic of Naomi, the aspiring artist in Minnesota in the 40s. And sometimes it was as simple as that, and sometimes it added complexity and richness to find something from his life in the strip, either chronologically or thematically.
Well, you know, I've thought about this a lot, but like when my own dad died a few years ago, I went through his personal effects and uncovered a number of things that disturbed me in a variety of ways. As someone who also writes biography, I have to admit, I would never want someone picking through the bones of my life and discovering and magnifying, as we do. I mean, that's what we do for a profession. My mistakes and idiosyncrasies. I don't want my wife to have to read. Oh well, you know, all of his friends remember that he had this unrequited affection for Andrea Passer in high school, and 30 years later, he still thought of her.
Yeah.
I mean, does that kind of stuff ever cross your mind in doing this kind of work? Do you ever have that moment of, you know, a little wince where you go, you know, maybe Sparky wouldn't really like me writing about this, and maybe I shouldn't. Maybe this I should set aside.
Well, I clearly the choice to the choices that led to a book that's only, and I say really mean, only 533 pages long, it shows how much I did have to leave out. It shows how severe the selection process is when the first draft of a thorough of my thorough full-length manuscript was about 1,800 pages long. So, to cover a life in a thorough way it is by itself a kind of trick, and it is a distortion, and it's an imperfect instrument for recreating a life. But I do believe that there is a way of looking at biography in the context of an artist's life that makes it valid to do what I did, which is to present the life and the work together. I can tell you absolutely that if someone wrote a book about my father and said anything critical, you know, I'd be unhappy too. I well understand this. But I also believe, and it just jumped into my head, I actually haven't even thought of this before now, this country embraced a story called The Bridges of Madison County. And in that story, a love affair is related to children who discover a trunk full of the evidence of this love affair in their mother's life after she's gone. And it enhances the discovery, painful as it is, that she had this relationship during her marriage, enhances their sympathy and understanding for what she went through as a person and for who she really was. And the truth hurts. And sometimes, along with the hurt that goes with truth, is a greater sympathy and a greater feeling of love for someone, because you now know more of who they were rather than less. And if what I've written about Charles Schulz makes people who love him uncomfortable, I have to believe that if you read it carefully and think it through, that there is enough there to love him the more for who he was, despite himself and despite the world that he was trying to grow out of. And I mean, we all have limitations, and I think one of the things I kept bumping up against with Schulz was a sense that he had triumphed over limitation, and his limitations were always visible to him. Indeed, down to the very last strip of Peanuts, the very last daily strip, is Snoopy pondering a snowball while a snowball fight is going on behind him that he can't participate in, because as the caption says, and it's not a thought balloon, it was a caption, the dog realized that his father hadn't taught him how to make a snowball. That's the last statement of Peanuts. It's a statement about limitations. It's about being alone with who you really are and what you were taught and what you were given. And I think that it's very important to understand, if you're going to try to understand Schulz at all, or you want to believe that you know who he was, that to know where he came from and how he dealt with the world that he grew up in and how he brought it into his adult life and what he did and didn't understand of his own life is very important to see.
Just a couple more minutes, Dave.
Yep,
you'd be
sure.
Very patient about this. And I particularly, you brought up his last strip, and I wanted to ask you about that. The coincidence that his last strip appeared the day that he died is too much for some skeptics.
Yeah.
And one comic fan I spoke to in preparing to talk to you insisted that I ask you this.
Okay.
Is there any chance that either Schulz, that either his passing was withheld from an announcement to coincide with that last strip because the two were so close? And he insists that I ask you this. Is there any chance that Schulz either, so to speak, pulled the plug himself or had a family member do it so that he and the strip went out together?
Well,
that sounds right.
is a completely valid question, and I was asked it frequently by the reporters such as Steve Croft from 60 Minutes, who had seen Schultz before his death, in the year before his death. Reporters and smart, engaged, thinking people who interacted with Schultz understood one of the simplest and basic facts about him, which he himself had put out there for years, which is that he always said, when the strip dies, when I die, the strip dies.
Right.
He also always said, I would feel very empty without this strip. I would, and in one case he had joked around saying, if I didn't have the strip, I'd be dead. He had time and time again showed how fused he believed his life and the strip were. And in the dismay and upset of the months that followed his stroke in November of 99, in the dismay of realizing he was not going to be carrying on Peanuts, he was profoundly shaken. And you see it in the interviews he gave at the time, and there's ample evidence to understand how completely baffled he was about how he was going to go on and what life meant now. So that to find some way to end his life as the strip ends would be logical. I have to say that in every way I looked at this, without going into a full-scale congressional investigation into it, I had to believe that no, he did not, or no, he was not, or no, there was no assistance, and that it would be inconsistent with everything I found to believe that that was true. However, I do think that, as I understand it to myself, I think he somehow witch-doctored himself to that point, or one hears about it all the time. You know, the giving up of life, whatever your belief system is, that it can engage in this question whether he gave himself up or whatever, however you see it. But the medical terminology used is the medical terminology given to me to understand this by his family, by his doctor, is just vague enough still to make one wonder. And there's no question that the question is valid. But I think I would have to conclude myself from everything I could find at the time that no, he went by natural causes.
Last question. Were there any other parts of this Charles Schultz puzzle that you were unable to solve after all these years?
Well, I wished from the beginning, and I still wish, that the clear evidence of his relationship with his mother had been left on paper more than by the hearsay and very considered evidence left by people who knew her and given in interviews. I wish there were her letters. I wish she had written to him. I wish there was on paper some way of seeing how she and Sparky had lived their life. The life of his boyhood, and whether or not there's any chance to understand his parents remains to be seen. There may yet come some moment where out of a shoebox comes all sorts of letters from his early life. But I felt that was a puzzle that I could only guess at or only become closer to understanding through the interview process and through a lot of legwork in historical societies turning out. You know, just seeing her death certificate and understanding that her death was a death by cervical cancer and not from colon cancer led through numerous channels of research and interviewing to new ideas about why Schultz had had the kind of experience he had in high school during her illness and so forth.
Wow. Well, David, thank you not only for joining us today but for contributing to what I think is officially the longest Mr. Media interview yet. And it was just fascinating to talk to you. I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thanks, Bob. And I'm really looking forward to comparing notes with you about cartoonists and biography.
Thanks. That would be interesting. David Michaelis's book, Schultz and Peanuts, is available at bookstores everywhere, or you can order it online at MrMedia.com. And folks, if you'd like to keep up with Mr. Media's Friday interviews, you can subscribe to the site via email at www.mrmedia.com. You can also subscribe to the audio feed in the podcast section of iTunes. Thanks for joining us today. Please come back again next week for another Fridays with Mr. Media.